I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Kevin Middleton. I'm here with Samantha Berg. And tonight, we are going to interview Dr. Amy Chadwick of Soaring Crane Natural Health Center. She's located in downtown Palmer. And we've had a long relationship with Amy. We've shared many patients in common and really thrilled to have her back on our show tonight. She's going to tell us about endobiogenic medicine. And as a naturopath, she's got a foundation in her work, which is always looking at a holistic solution to help the vitality, underlying vitality of the body heal itself. So endobiogeny is a system of medicine that assesses how the internal life of the body is generated and sustained. It's a systems theory of biology that considers the endocrine system to be the true manager of the body. The modern biomedical approach has produced a highly detailed understanding of physiology and offers impressive interventions for life-threatening and degenerative disorders. And where endobiogeny differs than to a standard biomedical approach is in its understanding of the body as a system. And it's a holistic, integrated, interrelated, interdependent system of physiology. And it requires an integrated approach to taking history, patient history, and treatment.
So I want to introduce Dr. Amy Chadwick to everyone. But before I do, I want to mention that we had Amy on our show about a year ago. So if you go to radiofreepalmer.org and you look under the Bridge to Everywhere tab and just scroll back to last year, if you want to listen to the talk that we did with Amy on naturopathic medicine in general, that's a really good introduction to Amy. And so I want to give you some information from her biography. So Amy Chadwick, naturopath, graduated with high honors from the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and Amy interned in women's medicine, pediatrics, and the treatment and management of chronic disease. Amy had the privilege of studying under some of the best physicians in the profession. Returning to Alaska, Amy now lives her lifelong dream practicing naturopathic medicine, listening to people tell their stories, witnessing the healing journey, and assisting her patients in finding and maintaining lifelong wellness. Amy is an avid reader and a scientist at heart, constantly learning, researching, and delving into the why behind each of her patients' imbalances. The search for why has led Dr. Amy to pursue a fellowship in endobiogenic medicine, a powerful and subtle paradigm that assesses a person's terrain and imbalance and recognizes the endocrine system as the global manager of all physiology. Each patient is responding to their environment based on their individual terrain and adaptive strategies. Once these are assessed, treatments often involve plant medicine, but a large toolbox allows Dr. Amy to treat individual layers of imbalance on all levels of wellness in each of her patients. So welcome back to the show, Dr. Amy. Great to have you here.
Yeah, great to have you. Here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
So the first thing that comes up for me when we were reading about endobiogenic medicine and when I was reading your bio is, what does the endocrine system do? So that's probably a good place to start, right?
It is a good place to start. That's usually the word that as soon as it comes out, I get a blank stare. And most of us are familiar with different systems of the body, like the digestive system or the nervous system or the immune system. The endocrine system is the system that involves all of our hormones. And that's not just the hormones that we tend to think about, like I have a problem with estrogen or my thyroid. It's all of our adrenal hormones. It's estrogen, testosterone, progesterone. It's the thyroid. It's growth hormone, prolactin, insulin, glucagon, plus the hormones that come out of the hypothalamus and pituitary that help to direct all of those.
So when you're talking about the endocrine system with someone, what would you say, like if somebody's saying that, well, I don't really understand what the endocrine system actually does in my body. There's all these substances that the endocrine system is releasing, but so what does it do?
So certainly from the endobiogenic perspective, the endocrine system manages our entire physiology. And that's, when we talk about managing, it's not like the dictator manager who forces everything to happen. It's this wise and observant leader who watches what's happening in the body, sees where something may be going off balance, and is able to predict what the body's needs are based on what it needs to adapt to in that moment, and is able to shift metabolism. It's able to shift the way we're managing our blood sugar. It's able to shift our responses in order to adapt to anything coming our way.
And we're talking about adapting. We're talking about adapting not only to what's going on inside our bodies, but also what's going on in our environment, correct? External.
Correct. It's a system of medicine that's really humanistic. It's looking at the human both in its full context, so its physiology and what's happening on a moment-to-moment basis at the cell, the tissue, the organ, and also how that human is relating with their environment. So we have to adapt in order to get out of bed in the morning, or to eat a meal, or to be on the radio and talk, or we have bigger aggressions, like a car accident or something, where the body has to go through a really major adaptation.
So how does stress figure in with this when you're working with patients?
Stress is certainly, I would say in some ways stress is a product of mismanagement, and in some ways it's a trigger for the body to need to manage. So we all have external stressors that we can or can't control. And the endocrine system, through its pattern of mobilizing the nutrients that we need to respond, helps us to manage that stress. It helps us to breathe at a regular pattern. It helps make sure there's enough nutrients to feed the cells to handle whatever stress is happening. For example, running a marathon, the endocrine system is going to make sure there's enough nutrients to feed the muscles to handle that kind of exercise. But also, if there's an imbalance in the way that that's being managed, that can come across as a stress or a sensation of stress within the body.
And go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of these functions that you're describing I associate with the nervous system. And so I'm wondering if you can compare and contrast a little bit.
So when we talk about, just to back up a little bit, when we look at being a manager, there are certain requirements in order to manage the body. So it has to be, it has to touch on every single cell and even clear down to the nucleus of the cell. It has to communicate with every cell in the body. It also has to be able to manage the different phases of life. So from conception through birth, through puberty, through childbearing years, through menopause, through death. It has to manage each of those transitions. And it has to be self-managing. So it has to be able to regulate its own patterns. That's what makes the endocrine system really the only system that can be the manager. If we look at something like the nervous system, the nerves themselves do impact every cell, but they are turned on or requested based on certain actions of the body. Where the autonomic nervous system comes in, which is our rest and digest or our fight-flight type nervous system, that nervous system does get involved in helping initiate certain states of adaptation. And we do look at that as part of the endocrine system managing. And I think of that system as acting a little bit more like hormones anyway. Adrenaline and noradrenaline circulate in the bloodstream more like hormones rather than traveling through a nerve to get to its endpoint.
Wow. So again, when we going back to stress, so this is another way to look into how different people respond to different stressors. I think there's maybe an idea of a certain way, you know, like a certain way somebody would respond to a car accident, or a certain way somebody would respond to eating a huge meal, or, you know, like you said, running a marathon. But it's really going to be very individual for the different person who's experiencing that stress. I know that we see a lot of times people seem to do fine with huge amounts of stress, you know, over, and it'll be like one thing after another. You know, maybe there's some kind of family issue that happens, and then there's a financial crisis, and then, you know, maybe people taking care of an elderly parent, and on, and they seem fine. And they do great with it, and then maybe 4 or 5 months later, everything crashes. Mm-hmm. And then there's the person who, you know, I mean, a little bit of an exaggeration, but a hangnail throws them over the edge, you know?
Right.
So, you know, so what's going on there?
This is the beauty, actually, of looking at the body from this perspective, is that we are looking at each individual person's terrain. So what sets up that terrain? What sets up the way that that person manages their physiology on a day-to-day basis? And for each one of us, that's a little bit different. And then what events happen throughout our life at different stages of development affect how the hormone or endocrine system is going to establish its patterns of reactivity. So certain things that happen in childhood can set up certain adaptive strategies that play out later in life and change the way we respond to certain diseases. If we're also not able to adapt in a healthy way to what's happening, the body will go into a state where symptoms can show up. So this is really the root. It's not that stress is the root of disease, but the inability of the body to adapt and come back to a state of equilibrium is what ultimately leads to disease. And so based on an individual person's terrain and the way they manage their physiology is going to have a giant impact on whether what may seem like a minimal stress has a big impact or not.
When you're using the word terrain, I'm wondering if you can maybe flesh that term out a little bit for the listeners.
Yeah, terrain is, it's really our entire being. So it's both our structure, our skeleton, our muscle system, our nervous system, and also our functional systems. So lymphatics and blood flow and all of these other things, this is our terrain. It is partially established by our genetics, and it's established also by the environment that we're living in. And endobiogeny says that basically our endocrine system is one with the terrain. The endocrine system is managing and is the terrain of the body. And it it is set, and yet it also shifts as we go through different adaptive strategies of our life. I also like thinking of it as our soil. It's like the soil that we're born into. And some people are born into really rich soil, and they can grow into these amazingly rich, full vegetables, and some aren't necessarily. And we have to, but the body will learn how to maintain its equilibrium given the soil that it has.
Yeah, I like that analogy. I was thinking substrate, but that's an even better way to say it. So since we love to talk about nutrition in here, I'm sure nutrition plays a bit of a role in this, in how well we adapt. Could you say a little bit about that? I know there's a huge amount of stuff that you can say on that topic, but just...
And maybe address the issue of water intake and how that plays out in hormonal function and endocrine function.
So all of these, interestingly, and this may sound, for people who've heard me talk before, this is a little bit different perspective, because from naturopathic medicine, and we wouldn't necessarily say this in naturopathic medicine, but there's a little bit of an attitude that the digestive system is really the manager of our physiology. And so therefore, we're constantly addressing what we're putting in to the digestive system. Looking at this from the endobiogenic perspective, it is true that life is all about digestion, but it's about digestion on all levels. It's being able to digest our nutrients that come in. It's being able to digest our experiences. And what really happens is what we're eating is going to create a need for the body to adapt in one way or another. So if a child is growing up in an environment where they don't have the nutrients they need to grow, their adaptive strategies are going to have to really ramp up to help manage their growth and help them grow in an appropriate way. And that's going to set up a pattern that will follow them throughout their life. This can explain certain patterns of being nutrient deprived and then how that leads to food patterns in adulthood or obesity or not being able to gain weight or other things. So nutrition plays a little bit different role. We talked the last time I was on here about gluten a lot, and one of the main issues from an endobiogenic perspective is that gluten is a really difficult to digest protein. So it's not a bad food or a good food, it's just really hard to digest. And because it's hard to digest, it asks the digestive system to work harder. And in order for the digestive system to work harder, it has to be managed by certain pieces of our endocrine system. Specifically, thyroid stimulating hormone helps the pancreas make more digestive enzymes. And so this is part of the connection between thyroid and gluten intolerance, is that the thyroid stimulating hormone is trying to get the pancreas to work harder and is also creating a stress on the thyroid at the same time.
So that's an interesting perspective, because I think, again, it's, I personally have more, a little bit more of a simplistic view on the hormones. So thinking about each hormone having multiple functions. Mm-hmm. So when you say thyroid stimulating hormone, of course, I'm thinking about, doesn't that just stimulate the thyroid to work? So when you're talking about relationships with all the hormones, each one of the hormones can affect all the other systems in other, in smaller ways or larger ways for that matter. So again, you're looking at the relationships between the whole hormonal system.
And so maybe in the classical Western view of the endocrine system, at least the way we learned it in undergraduate, is really these are separate functioning operations, right? And you don't really think about crossover and interrelationships.
Right. Whereas what we know and what's even been shown in research over the last 70 years, it just hasn't always been brought together into this cohesive structure, is that not only do the hormones work in their classic sort of vertical patterns, the way we learned them, that, you know, from hypothalamus to pituitary to end gland, but they also communicate horizontally between each other, and they also communicate radially. So there's this incredible intercommunication, and hormones work in groups.
So let's take the example of thyroid-stimulating hormone, because we have plenty of patients who come in and they are told they have high hypothyroid, so they have high TSH. So, and it sounds like what you're saying, they could have high TSH because of their diet, because the TSH is trying to stimulate the pancreas to work harder. So take me through from there what happens if you just look at that number on the blood test and you say, oh, given the reference range, the person has high TSH, and you don't really have any other information than that, and you just assume that it means that the person has low thyroid function. Where does that end up, and how would you treat that differently from an endobiogenic perspective?
Right, because it seems like there's an incredible diagnostic spectrum that opens up with what you're describing.
There is. There is. Thyroid has been one of the most surprising arenas for me to look at, because it is one that I think classically we treat and we pretty aggressively treat. And it's one that, especially in medicine now, we look at lab values, and even if they look in normal range, we tend to have this conversation about, well, it's maybe not quite normal enough. It's not as high as it should be. And so we treat based on that, plus symptoms. Treating symptoms is really not being fair to a patient. Symptoms are what's happening in that moment. And if we're not looking at their entire physiology and what's happening with them as a person and in their life, we're not really treating them in the most appropriate or beneficial way that we can. So thyroid is a classic one where we come in with this list, and we have the list of classic thyroid symptoms of hair loss and tired and skin dry, and the TSH is a little bit elevated. And so thyroid hormone is often prescribed. What I have found is, yes, TSH, just like all of our hypothalamic and pituitary hormones, has receptors on every cell of the body. So TSH can have a global impact, and the job of the thyroid axis is really to mobilize energy, to provide energy for other parts of the endocrine system to use to build. So TSH is trying to do that. It's trying to mobilize energy. It can do that by increasing digestive enzymes out of the pancreas. It can do it by having an effect on our insulin resistance or sensitivity at the cell level. And so one of the things that we use in endobiogeny is we look also at enzymes that manage energy action at the cell itself as part of our blood work to say, what is the actual metabolic activity of thyroid? And for example, I had a patient this morning whose TSH was on the high end of normal, but when we put her numbers together and really look at the relationships between them, she actually has metabolically a hyperthyroid activity with also what we would call hypercentral thyroid activity. So both her hypothalamic and her pituitary, TRH and TSH, are also elevated. And just giving her thyroid in the past has not made her feel very well. So this has not worked.
Yeah, and I commonly see that. There are some people who just genuinely, you know, their thyroid levels are low. And obviously I see people who don't have a thyroid. And so those people, it makes sense for them to be on thyroid meds. Okay. But I see people who come in and they say, well, I was put on the thyroid hormone. And for a while it seemed to make a difference. And now it's sort of tapped out.
So using hormones in treatment can be really essential. And that's one thing about endobiogeny is we don't rule out any treatment. But the goal is to use a treatment in the most specific way that we can. So if we're using a pharmaceutical treatment or a substitutive treatment, it's hopefully for a limited period of time while we're working on the terrain to bring balance back to the system. And certainly there are situations where we need to use certain substitutive treatments forever. But in this case with thyroid, the other thing to remember is that if our endocrine system is managing our physiology, it's even managing how we transition from season to season. So our thyroid function is going to change to move us through fall into winter and then back through spring back into summer. So the function that we see just looking at straight thyroid labs is just taking a snapshot in time and not really looking at how that management is occurring. So using a substitutive treatment like thyroid or like estrogen or something else, I've heard the analogy, it's like plucking one note of an instrument. And oftentimes when we can use plant medicine, it's more like using the whole symphony to actually support the system in its function.
Mm-hmm. And I have one more question along those lines, and then I want to get into how this would look in practice when somebody comes in. So What are the kinds of symptoms or what are the kinds of dangers you would see in just continuing to supplement a hormone without looking at the underlying terrain and without looking at how everything's operating together? Like, I think the question would be, what's the long-term effect? And we can pick the thyroid gland, for instance, on just supplementing or even on the ovaries if you just continue to supplement estrogen. What does the gland do? Does it actually atrophy in some way and not
dissipate?
Function? Yeah, what happens there?
So using a substitutive treatment has the potential to, first of all, mask the symptoms that the body is using in order to adapt. So it takes away sometimes the messages or the information that the body was using to create a strategy for adaptation at that time.
Can I interrupt real quick right there? So a symptom which we normally associate with discomfort, something that's unpleasant, could be really a positive engagement in the body that will come and pass and leave you in a state of well-being if only left alone. Is that?
It is. The body is wise. Mm-hmm. And if we approach medicine from that place, that the body is working with all of the wisdom that it has to bring us back to a place of balance, then we can look at each thing that may look like a problem and say, why is the body utilizing this this possibility? Why is this happening from a perspective of it's trying to do its best?
Okay.
Yeah, one of our teachers actually says, you know, when you have a symptom, it's like dig here for buried treasure. it's not let's make that symptom go away. Right. You know, of course, if somebody walks into our office and they're in pain, I would like to help them get out of pain. And it's pointing to something going on in the body. And so to figure that out, to take the time to actually work that through and figure out why the symptom is being generated, not just come from the approach of, oh, we need to make that go away, makes so much more sense.
Yeah, yeah. The other, a substitute treatment we're talking about that can also block the adaptive response. So it can keep the body from adapting through all of the other strategies that it was trying to do. And this is where we don't necessarily see physiologically that glands atrophy necessarily when we use substitutive treatments, but it does interrupt the normal feedback system that was happening within the body. And hormones act on receptors, so it can change the number of receptors, it can change the activity of receptors, and can therefore change the way the body responds if we try to come off of that hormone as well.
Does this happen with supplements as well? So if somebody does, supplements a lot with particular vitamins or particular nutrients, like I'm thinking again in the case of thyroid, you know, somebody who takes a lot of selenium or takes a lot of iodine, can that affect this whole system as well?
Not to the same degree, but it is also important to use those nutrients based on a given terrain. So just because somebody may have peripheral thyroid insufficiency and we're working with that doesn't mean that for them iodine is the best treatment. And for another person, it absolutely is. So this allows us to really cater the treatment to the patient's terrain and what their body is doing rather than having this global idea that, well, it's a thyroid issue, it must need iodine.
Great, great. One thing I wanted to ask you about, in the process of an examination, a patient comes in, they're going to see you, they want to explore this work. I'm just in the reading I'm doing now, it talks about the endobiogenic physical exam. So it says, and I'm just going to read this, and I want you maybe to interpret and elaborate a little bit. It says, the endobiogenic exam reveals a great deal of information through its evaluation of the phenotypic expression of neuroendocrine activity and the state of the organs that drain, excrete, and secrete. For example, the length of eyelashes, the fat on the zygomatic arch, very interesting, and the pain on deep palpation of the ascending colon. So just curious how that all relates to neuroendocrine relationships and function.
So the endocrine system is managing our structure as much as our function. So we talk about it in terms of how we adapt to a stress, but the endocrine system played a role in the way we grew in the womb and as we were developing. It plays a role in our structure now as adults as well. So things like length of eyelashes and curl of eyelashes have a specific endocrine pattern that initiates that growth or development. And that is something that will change. There are women who notice their eyelashes get longer and more curled at different points during their cycle because that's partially driven by follicle stimulating hormone. So we can look at very specific parts of a physical exam and get a sense of where different hormones are playing a role within that body or where there may be a greater demand. Within the colon, for example, the hormones that come from the ovaries or the testes, it's called our gonadotropic axis. Those hormones are really in charge of building proteins and building structure. So if they are being asked to do more building, they may also solicit an overgrowth of tissue in certain parts of the colon that are able to absorb more proteins from the diet. And wow. So when we're palpating in those areas, there will be a tenderness in an area where there's been a congestion or increase of growth in that tissue.
So now we're getting back to everything happens for a reason, which is interesting. And so you really become a body detective. Mm-hmm. And so it shows you it really does play into the who is the person who's walking into your treatment room with this particular set of symptoms is just as important as the symptoms. So something we'll often say to people is that your symptom didn't walk in not attached to you. Mm-hmm. Like asthma has never walked into my treatment room. You know, sciatica has never walked into my treatment room and on, you know, pink eye, whatever it is, it's always attached to a complicated human being. Mm-hmm. And so looking at all of these functions of the endocrine system is giving, you know, a window into why that is, why mm-hmm. you cannot just treat a symptom in isolation.
Yeah, the person walking in is more important to me. Their story, their history, the endobiogenic history is a long history where we talk about childhood, puberty, what personality were you like as a child? Were you gentle or stubborn or feisty? What kinds of things happened during that time? Even questions about prenatal environment, type of birth that you had, what's happened at different stages during life, because these give us a clue as to how your endocrine system has adapted throughout its major transitions of life. And then the physical exam gives us more information along that line, and we can pull all those pieces together to create a treatment that's catered to the person. I don't have a protocol for menopause or for thyroid even. I have what does this patient need based on all of these factors that are coming together.
Interesting. I want to know, like, if you're palpating, let's say, the ascending colon, and it's tender and sensitive, is that always a pathological indication, or could it be somebody who's in a growth spurt?
It can be in a growth spurt. It could be a certain solicitation and demand for proteins for any reason. We need proteins to build white blood cells to fight off an infection. We need protein to restructure tissue after an injury. So any time that the body, or if the body is just in that terrain of being in kind of an overgrowth or hyperanabolic terrain, that can also solicit that tendency. So not pathology necessarily at all.
And okay, we're going to be taking a break here in just a minute, but just to follow up with that, how do you make a distinction then? You know, if there's a tenderness and it is clearly a lot of metabolic activity, you then would pair it with their complaint if they have a complaint, and then you might pair it with other visible or, you know, information that's coming.
Yeah. Should we talk about it after the break?
I think we should probably talk about it after
okay.
the break.
Yeah, okay. Sounds really great.
Okay. So you're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we're speaking with Dr. Amy Chadwick about endobiogenic medicine, and we will be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, broadcasting as KVRF, FM 89.5 on your FM dial. Contact us at radiofreepalmer.org if you would like to volunteer and be part of your community station.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the second half of Bridge to Everywhere. We're talking with Dr. Amy Chadwick of Soaring Crane. She's a naturopath in downtown Palmer, and we are talking about endobiogenic medicine. And Amy was just about to answer a question from Kevin. Do you want to repeat your question?
I'm not sure I can exactly. But we were elaborating, I think, on the process of diagnosis. So when somebody has a tender area that you're palpating and it shows increased metabolic activity and a given endocrine function, how do you make the distinction and differential diagnosis? You pair it with other visible cues, there are symptoms they're complaining about, and I'm just wondering how that all integrates into a comprehensive treatment plan. Mm-hmm.
So an endobiogenic evaluation does not replace standard screening tools or what you might normally expect from your doctor. So for me, as somebody who tends to practice sometimes specialty medicine and sometimes primary care, depending on what a patient needs when they come in, I have to take that into account. And I'm definitely looking at their history, at what else is going on, what other signs are there. There are plenty of patients who have kind of a non-specific, perhaps tenderness in their abdomen that is not pathological at all. But it is definitely my job as a physician to not automatically assume that it's not pathologic and to work with what other possibilities are there and to look at their whole physiology. There's definitely... there is an art and a science to medicine, and that comes into play with every patient and is necessary in this realm, especially where sometimes I may be the primary person who's diagnosing something for a patient, that I may look at it from its functional perspective, and I'm still going to treat it from that endobiogenic perspective, even if, let's say, I palpate the abdomen and I find a tumor, there still is an endobiogenic terrain that has led to that tumor. And my treatment will be informed by that, but I'll also be running a CT scan and an ultrasound and sending them to the specialist needed for that treatment.
Great. So let's get a sense of somebody comes into your office and they're wanting to do the endobiogenic medicine and the results that you generate that I've seen are something you call the biology of functions. And so you at the end of this, somebody gets basically several pieces of paper that explains what's going on in their individual endocrine system. So what I want to talk about is how do we get from point A to point B? So person walks into your office and they have some collection of symptoms. What do you do how do you go about evaluating them? What's the steps? And then what do you do once they've got regular blood work? What do you do with that information and how do you put that all together?
Okay. So a first patient appointment or somebody coming in usually for an endobiogenic evaluation, even if they've been a patient before, it's a 90-minute appointment. And that is my opportunity to take this detailed history. So they have the opportunity to tell me what symptoms they're experiencing, what's happening. There'll be a lot of questions to get more information about what's happening for them and their symptoms. And then these other questions about their life that I pull together. I also do the physical exam during that visit. That's generally a kind of head-to-toe physical exam that we're doing to get more information. And then we order labs. The labs are the biology of functions, and this is kind of the third leg to endobiogeny. We can do endobiogeny, and we can treat terrain based on history and physical, and there are many, many physicians who do that. The biology of functions really allows us to get even more subtle and more specific in a way that I find really fascinating and fun, and really, really powerful, because there are things that we can see on that we can't just see with history and physical.
And when you say labs, this is a blood test.
It is a blood test. Yeah. It's a normal blood test. It involves many of the labs that you would just generally see on a screening lab work, but it also involves a few markers that are not generally run on a screening lab. And that's why, if a patient brings their labs to me that they may have had run in the last couple of months, I can't usually use those to do a biology of functions evaluation. What we're doing with this, because we're looking at the endocrine system managing, we need that snapshot in time. And so we need all of the biological markers that we're using in the blood to come from one blood draw so that we can look at their relationship to each other. Because this isn't just looking at TSH by itself or just looking at white blood cells by itself. It's looking at their relationship to other things within the blood to understand how it's being managed.
So do you need to use a specific lab to get your information, or can you use any lab with any markers? Because I know different labs have different reference ranges. So they say different things are normal and different things are out of range. So is there a particular lab that you use for this, or does it matter?
I can use any lab. I have a contract with a lab just for financial purposes that is cheaper for my patients generally, but I can order from any lab. I can order all of the indices that we use, and it's actually built into the values that we have to enter the reference ranges for some of those labs that vary. So I do use a software program that does the math for me, thankfully, but it does all of the ratios. And into that program, I put reference ranges so that it normalizes no matter where the lab mm-hmm. occurred.
Blood chemistry is really dynamic. And I'm just wondering, you know, one single blood draw, you know, you're capturing a moment in time. Are there some conditions where you absolutely have to get multiple draws to get a realistic picture?
Mm-hmm. It's helpful. For instance, let's say a woman has very different symptoms the week before her period and the week after her period, dramatically different. It will give me a much better picture if we get a draw from both of those times, and we'll be able to see what's happening in that physiology. It's also very useful, especially when I'm first beginning to treat a patient, to get a draw at least seasonally to watch how their body is handling the seasonal transitions.
So so you take the lab tests and you put them through a series of calculations, mm-hmm. basically, and that gives you a sense of how the whole endocrine system is working together.
Correct. We use 17 biomarkers. There are, you know, the blood, like Kevin said, is dynamic. It carries cellular parts, our white blood cells and our red blood cells. It carries just things that need to be transported from one place to another within the blood. And then it also carries elements of cells that have died and are being transported around. So we can see a lot from the blood. And the blood is really, it is the circulation of life. It is the movement of our chi in our life. And so the blood becomes a very, very useful tool for seeing what's happening throughout our whole body. In this particular model, and this was designed by a brilliant physician in France, Dr. Dorofor, who apparently was able to intuit mathematically, which is phenomenal to me. But he was able to see these ratios and look at how they correlated to physiology
wow.
within his patients.
Wow.
So we're able to take these 17 biomarkers, and then they are looked at in relationship to each other. So some of the ratios are just simple, like white blood cell to red blood cell gives us one of our indices. In particular, that gives us our relationship of estrogens to testosterone within the body. And some of them are these very in-depth ratios that give us that information. So at that point, I take all the information that I have from the patient, and then I look at numbers. The numbers don't mean anything to me without having done the history and physical. I could be handed, you know, 20 different biology of functions, which is the lab work, and not be able to really make an efficient treatment plan just from that without understanding the person and the why their blood may look this way at this given time. So I spend time then analyzing that and looking through all the aspects of the endocrine system and how are those different aspects of the endocrine system working together for this specific patient coming in with these specific issues. And how do we address those issues? Or if they're coming in for prevention, how do we just optimize their physiology?
And then what's the next step after that? So you sit down with the patient. So they've come in, they've done the 90-minute history, you've done the physical exam, we've done the blood work, and then you take all that information together and you have a somewhat coherent picture of what's going on for the person that, you know, you can start working from there. And so now what's the next step now? The patient comes back in and you're going to discuss that with them, what the results are, and then what are you going to have them do and what are you going to do?
So yeah, I have them come back for a follow-up, and really that follow-up is my chance to try to distill all this information in a way that's useful for them. So that is why I do a write-up for patients. It's something that is not, I don't know whether that will last forever, but it's something that I do right now to give people something to take home, because as we begin talking about somebody's physiology, it's really easy to just glaze over and not have any idea what's happening. So I write that up, and in that I have also put together a treatment plan for that patient. In, like I said earlier, in endobiogenic medicine, there's no treatment that is off the table. Everything is a possibility. But when we're really addressing the terrain, there are certain tools that are more beneficial than others. And plant medicine in particular has an amazing wisdom for treating the terrain. A plant has the ability to address multiple aspects of the endocrine system in the same way that it works cohesively and as a group. So I could put together a tincture, which is just a combination of plants in liquid form, in four or five plants that will address somebody's whole endocrine terrain and balance that they take a couple of times a day in a fairly small dose and can be much more effective than using higher doses of other treatments because we've really looked at what their ultimate cause is or how they're balancing.
When you're saying plant medicine, what you're doing is, you mentioned before, mother tinctures. What you're doing is you've got some part of the plant that's, it's an alcohol extract that you're
usually
using?
It can be alcohol or glycerin.
Okay. So it's some, it's an extract from a particular part of the plant. Mm-hmm. And then you're combining. So there's, so more or less medicinal aspects of the plant, less so than maybe more nutritional aspects of the plant that would be more of a water
extraction? It can be both. A tincture. And we can use plants in tea form with water mm-hmm. extraction. We can use them in tincture form. We can also use them in what's called a gemotherapy form, where we're using the buds of the plants, and then essential oil form. So all of those are used in endobiogeny, and each have different and specific properties and usefulness. Sometimes it's just a matter of finances. Tea is much cheaper, but harder to do. You have to make it every day. Mm-hmm. Tinctures have a certain potency to them because the plant has been extracted in alcohol and it has pulled out particular parts of the chemical nature of that plant. And essential oils has its own very energetic properties.
Do you find that patients vary in their sensitivity and dosage?
They do. They do. The doses are small, very small doses. We're talking like 2 or 3 milliliters twice a day in these herbs. So it's very small plant doses. If you were to talk to other kind of herbal medicine amounts, or it's a couple cups of tea a day, but that varies by the patient and what's needed.
Are there any side effects to using the plant medicine?
As with anything, there's always that possibility. There's the need to dilute it often, just because taking something in that strong of a tincture form can irritate the mouth a little bit. For some patients, as we're beginning to shift that terrain, there can be a number of symptoms that come up that either means I didn't get the treatment right and I need to revisit it and figure it out, or means we need to shift the dose a little bit because the patient isn't quite ready for that directive treatment.
And could it be that if there is some symptomatic outcome, could that be a healing effect?
It can be. The concept of like a healing crisis is there. It's not one that I eagerly adopt. I don't think we have to go through crisis to heal. So I generally, it's not my goal to push that for people. And if somebody says to me, oh, I feel the worst I've ever felt, but I think it's just a healing crisis, I usually revisit the treatment and say, where do we need to look at this differently?
And so what you were talking about almost sounds, because you're using such small amounts, because you're getting much more precise. Mm-hmm. Are there things, like I'm thinking about, we've spoken to a homeopath here, Dr. Joni Kirk, on air before, and we talked about certain things that can antidote homeopathy. So, you know, if you have like a strong essential oil or you know, mint.
Chocolate or something.
Certain things can affect, like, so if you might be taking the perfect formula for you, but then you do something and it really throws things off. Do you find that with this medicine as well, that there's anything that the person can do that, you know, like they shouldn't be taking other essential oils when you're giving them particular essential oils, or does that not seem to be a problem with this approach?
I don't see any problem with antidoting. I have a different theory on even whether we can antidote the right homeopathic remedy, but I certainly am aware of what other people are taking, and essential oils or aromatherapy is a good example of that, because essential oils are incredibly powerful modulators of the endocrine and hormone system and the nervous system. And so if I am using essential oils or any treatment with a patient, I definitely want to know what they're using on the side. And especially as more and more patients are beginning to take essential oils on their own orally, the effects of those on their endocrine system I take into account, certainly when I'm putting their treatment plan together. And I may or may not encourage them to continue or discontinue.
Yeah, I just think of those essential oils as very strong medicine to be used with respect.
Yes, they are very strong.
Yeah.
Thieves oil comes to mind. Uh-huh. It's a powerful, powerful blend.
Mm-hmm. And they're blended often in ways that, if we are looking at it from an endobiogenic perspective of what's important for this person's terrain, that's going to be very different than a global just antimicrobial blend. Because one oil may be antimicrobial, but may really increase somebody's parasympathetic nervous system and therefore increase their congestive state given their terrain. So it's useful to really understand, for this patient, is that appropriate? Do we actually want to be stimulating that activity?
Got it. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the effect of sleep and exercise on hormone function, and if there are specific systems that people wish to know about?
Yeah, I mean, the gland that we don't talk about a lot as part of the endocrine system is the pineal gland. And it's such a vital part of the endocrine system, and it is one of the major managers of adaptation. We tend to adapt through our pineal gland as much as we do through our pituitary. And the pineal isn't just about sleep and waking. It is this concept of cycles, so day and night cycles, seasonal cycles, and rhythm in our life. So maintaining that healthy rhythm and acknowledging that when there are sleep challenges or when there are lifestyle patterns that are really affecting sleep, that's going to ask the body to adapt in a really intense way that can have long-term consequences. Basically, when the body's being asked to adapt, it can either adapt easily and come back to its state of equilibrium, or if it's being asked to adapt for a long period of time or to a prolonged stressor, the normal buffering systems get tired or wear out, and that's when potentially disease can develop. So it's whenever we can't come back to a state of equilibrium. So somebody may be able to work night shifts for 20 years and be fine. Somebody else may not, or may notice that each time they've worked night shifts, they've started to develop some health issues, and this is their buffering system isn't able to bring them back into equilibrium with that shift in pattern. Exercise is the same. It's an adaptation. So looking at the biology of functions and working with a patient, I may be able to give information that one person actually needs more stillness in their life or more quiet motion, and another person may need more vigorous activity. When we're looking at the endocrine system managing, we're looking at both structure, how it's managing the actual structure and moment-to-moment cell activity of the body, versus how it's managing in function. And we can extrapolate that to say, how is this person operating when they're still versus when they're moving, or when they're alone versus when they're social, or when they need to adapt in some way, and that can affect the treatment plan as well.
So I think it'd be fun to talk a little bit about case studies. Obviously, we can do that kind of generally.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking particular things that I'm seeing a lot of, you know, maybe autoimmune kinds of conditions. So anything come to mind in that spectrum dealing with?
And to tag on to that, mm-hmm. is sometimes we'll see patients who have a sudden weight gain, mm-hmm. you know, just out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering anything like on that you might say.
Figure out where to start there. Some of those are more complicated than others. Weight gain is certainly one of them. There are basically two different kinds of weight gain and obesity. One is in which the fat cells just become bigger, and one is in which we produce more fat cells. And they are two different endocrine terrains that lead to that. There's a big adrenaline component in making fat cells bigger. There's a greater action of noradrenaline, or being in a state of fight-flight, and an activity of prolactin that plays a role in making more fat cells. The noradrenaline and the prolactin actually open up estrogen receptors on the fat cells that allows for more growth of those cells. And that tends to be the type of weight gain that is often really difficult to lose. And it's the patients who come in who say, I'm only eating 1,000 calories and I'm exercising this much and nothing is budging. And it's not that diet isn't important, but there are other factors that have to be addressed, or else this just becomes a greater stress for the patient and a potential for more weight gain.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, that's huge to think about that, because it's very common that we see people who say, I'm exercising a lot, you know, mm-hmm. and I've changed my diet and I've done this and that, but I cannot get those extra 15 pounds off. They just won't go.
Right. And we see that, you know, from before this, you certainly see the patient who just suddenly has a change in lifestyle pattern and they lose 20 pounds, or, you know, the stress comes off and suddenly they can lose weight. That is a shift in their endocrine terrain that suddenly allows them to come back to a state of equilibrium.
Got it.
So let's talk about, so any particular autoimmune conditions that you've seen looking from this window with the endobiogeny have an effect on? I know a lot of people come through with the more vague diagnoses of fibromyalgia and or chronic fatigue syndrome, but anything on the, let's say, like MS spectrum or lupus, those kinds of things that you've seen yet?
I'm hesitant to get into that terrain because I'm still, that's definitely an area that I'm still learning a lot.
Okay, let's maybe do something a little less complicated than autoimmune.
Yeah, I mean, you had mentioned asthma before.
Yeah, asthma is a good one to look at.
And also maybe we can talk about men. We're seeing more men with low testosterone. Mm-hmm.
That's a good one too.
That,
So asthma first, this was another one that was kind of one of those like mind re-altering moments when we talked, when I learned about asthma from this perspective. Because we tend to think about asthma and the closing of the bronchioles and the constriction in the lungs and the phlegm production as all the negative aspects of asthma. They are what is keeping us from getting air. And so we use drugs to stop that. We use drugs to clear the mucus. We use drugs to expand the lungs back out. But if we look at this from the perspective of the body is wise, there is an adaptive strategy for the body to actually close down those bronchioles and create more mucus in the attempt to trap oxygen in the lungs so that the blood gets more of that oxygen. So asthma is really an oxygen debt. It's some part of the body, or even the whole body, not feeling like it's getting enough oxygen at the cellular level to make energy. Our cells basically need sugar and oxygen to come together to make energy. And if the cell is able to get plenty of sugar but not enough oxygen, it can create this oxygen debt, and there will be management strategies that will go into play to say, well, how do I get more oxygen? I breathe more, or I allow the oxygen to sit in the lungs for longer so that the blood has more time to fill up.
Wow. So the lungs can actually extract oxygen from mucus.
They're not extracting oxygen from the mucus, but the mucus is creating a barrier so that the air stays in the lungs longer. So it traps air. It's a policy of trapping the air because the blood is running through the lung tissue at a certain rate. And the only way to really slow the amount of time that the blood has to interface with the oxygen is to keep the oxygen in the lung longer. As soon as you exhale, that oxygen is gone and then it has to come back in again.
Wow.
So this helps trap some of the oxygen there and allows the blood to absorb more oxygen to feed this debt.
So in this situation, if you are purely focused on trying to get the amount of mucus in the lungs down and the person is still doing a really great job of getting sugar into their cells, but they're not getting oxygen particularly well, you've just stopped their ability to get more oxygen, what happens?
You have symptomatically treated their problem. They may be able to breathe for a little while, which is necessary, and we have to do that. Obviously, asthma can be an emergency crisis, so people need to be able to breathe. And this is an example of the body having a management strategy that was perhaps overcompensated or inappropriate for the situation. So the strategy is there, and it is the wisdom of the body, but it may be detrimental in the long run. So we do have to address getting the lungs to open up and allowing breathing to happen. But to ultimately change whether or not they continue to have asthma attacks or not, we have to change this metabolic relationship at the cell.
So maybe you're focusing on the whole glucose side of the picture is being ignored in that case.
And it's not just a matter of how much sugar they're eating. It's really how their body is managing glucose at the cellular level, which has to do with thyroid and cortisol and...
So anything to say about stone formation, the tendency towards stone formation in the body from this perspective, either kidney stones or gallstones?
So the minerals of our body are also being managed and moved by the endocrine system. And the bone is a really, really important metabolic organ. So in endobiogeny, we look at it as one of the reserves of the body. The body can use the liver, it can use the bone as these big metabolic reserves in order to adapt. And part of the way the bone does that is by allowing calcium to come in and out of it and to be used appropriately for adaptation. If the body is in a certain endocrine terrain, there's the possibility that it will be depositing those minerals in places where there already is... there's already an energetic demand. Mm-hmm. So there's a reason why one person may develop kidney stones and somebody else may develop a different kind of calcification, like a bone spur or something else. And that has to do with other parts of their terrains. And this is where this connection with acupuncture has been really interesting for me in thinking about it in terms of the energy of the organs. If we, connect kidney energy with fear or something like that, there can be a deep underlying emotional pattern in that person that allows the kidney to be the organ that then plays out in this adaptation, and the stones will form there.
Yeah, it always seems to me, again, that we're not, by not addressing the reason why the organ is forming the stones, that you're really doing a disservice, you know. But and, you know, we can't just take out people's kidneys, but we often take out people's gallbladders.
Yes.
So, you know, that's really common. Or I think another example in this case would be something like just the tendency towards putting growth somewhere. So it would be like fibroids,
right,
or endometriosis. And so, again, we can, if somebody's not planning on using their uterus in the future, we could take that out.
We can take it out, yeah, but we create a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And if the body has a terrain that is tending toward this type of irregular growth or fibrosing type growth, that tendency toward fibrosis has a lot to do with the balance between estrogens and androgens and estrogen receptor activity. And if the uterus, for example, has a lot of estrogen receptors on it. So there's a reason why somebody who tends to create this kind of fibrous growth grows on their uterus and in their breasts. If we remove the uterus, then we've basically removed a big portion of those estrogen receptors, but the body still sees a need to stimulate estrogen receptors for protein development. And so it will do that somewhere else in the body. And there have been some studies that have looked at rates of breast cancer development after hysterectomy and other things like that. And the endobiogenic theory is looking into, how does this have to do with, we create this hole by removing the uterus, and then the breast tissue becomes the next best place to grow, basically, as a management strategy?
Yeah, there is a concept in Chinese medicine of what's called divergent channels, and that whatever this process is, it's keeping it away from
the more vital organs.
So, you know, and so often we see things showing up in women in the uterus, or men, it tends to be the prostate. Everybody tends to be gallbladder, though it seems like women tend to have more gallbladder issues. But, you know, adenoids, tonsils.
Women from Long Island, actually.
Yeah.
I saw a study.
Yeah? Oh, interesting. Yeah. Great. Yeah. I'll have to watch out for that. But yeah. So it's this concept of, again, the body's wise. The body's putting something someplace for a reason. And if we interrupt that process and we don't figure out why that process is happening, we don't address it on the level of the process, that we're going to create a problem somewhere down the line.
Yes. Yeah. Especially with these. This is where endobiogeny really shines, is in functional disorders. You know, it's these things that we really don't have a good biomedical treatment for, other than surgery and removing an organ. But there is a terrain that leads to that process. And surgery may be necessary. You know, this isn't ruling this out. And it doesn't mean that if you've had your uterus removed that you are going to have these other risks. But it is worthwhile to, at least in my mind, to not just say, well, I had that problem taken care of, and so now I don't need to deal with that.
Right.
It's absolutely a part of your history. And it becomes a part of my information in treating, to say, let's treat that process.
Amy, yeah, we're down to the last minute. I'm wondering if you can help the guys out a little bit. Just tell us a little bit about testosterone, and if, you know, for folks who are experiencing low levels of testosterone, what would you say to them?
You know, it's often more about the balance of testosterones and estrogens, and also how the adrenals are able to help out in that hormone production. So there is a certain process to that terrain, and understanding that and working with the balance between the hormones, I have seen be much more beneficial than directly giving testosterone. Again, for these reasons we've talked about, mm-hmm, it's a substitutive treatment that starts to interrupt other processes. But there are some great herbs that help to build testosterone activity within the body for it to do its job of laying down structure.
That's great.
So. And so where can people contact you if they would like to make an appointment for an endobiogenic evaluation?
They can call Soaring Crane Natural Health Center at 745-3999 or go to our website at soaringcraneclinic.com.
Awesome.
Great.
Dr. Amy Chadwick,
thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.